It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Lots of people smoke or ingest pot in the U.S. Not everybody does so legally, but Canada just voted to make recreational marijuana legal all over the country. Now the real work begins. Robert Mikos is professor of law at Vanderbilt University. His research looks at the struggle among federal, state, and local governments for control of marijuana law and policy. He's also the author of the book, Marijuana Law, Policy, and Authority. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
So I just moved here from Nevada. I feel like a great deal of my radio career at this point has been dedicated to exploring the opportunities and pitfalls of a rollout of legalized recreational marijuana. This is not as easy as it seems, is it?
No, it's not. Many people think of this as a choice between prohibiting the drug and legalizing it. But there are all sorts of different policy choices that have to be made that can put you somewhere between those two extremes. Things like, how do we regulate the labeling of the product? Mm. What sort of advertising do we allow? Where are we going to allow stores? Are we going to allow local governments to opt out of this and impose their own regulations? Will we restrict employers from terminating employees who use the drug off the job? There are lots of different choices that ultimately have to be made, typically after you make that first decision to legalize the drug.
And one of the things about labeling is that you don't want labeling that is bright and attractive that a five-year-old might pick up.
That's right. A lot of the concerns that states have now that have legalized the drug are really about restricting access to minors, both accidental ingestion, but also sort of marketing to minors. And so they're trying to restrict the packaging of the drug, what it looks like when you walk out of the store with it. They try to restrict the forms that it'll take. They don't want manufacturers putting the psychoactive compounds into, for example, gummy bears that might be appealing to children. So that's one of the big concerns that's raised and one of the big issues that states have to confront when they legalize this drug.
So no Joe the Camel cartoons on the front of these kinds of packages.
Well, that's right. At least, you know, in Canada, one of the interesting things they're doing there is they're requiring manufacturers to put these products into very plain packages that look kind of like generic cigarette packages, I suppose. When it's in the form of a joint. That's not necessarily what's happened here in the States. You actually do see a lot of different, very colorful and appealing packages being used and sold in stores throughout the United States. So that's one area where Canada may be differing from what the states have done here domestically.
So first of all, let's just talk about Canada. Did this come up for them, and why national? Why didn't they just do it province by province like we're doing it state by state?
It's a great question. So this first arose actually more than a decade ago when it came to medical marijuana, and it was interesting that in Canada, that actually happened through the court system. The courts there recognized what in the United States would be a fundamental due process right to use marijuana for medical purposes. And then the government had to respond to that and adapt its laws to accommodate those medical uses. That was back around 2001. Then when the new prime minister was elected put in, this is Justin Trudeau, back in 2015, he made this part of his platform. And he promised at that point that he would expand access to marijuana, that he would legalize it for recreational purposes. In part, he said to restrict access by minors. He thought that black market dealers were marketing to minors, and that if we legalize this, you could actually restrict that access.
Was there evidence to show that? Was there evidence to show that, or was that just a selling point?
Well, I think it's a selling point, but there's certainly evidence that minors have easy access to the drug, both in the United States and in Canada. There's a question whether, you know, if you legalize it, could you ironically restrict that access? I think that's yet to be proven, but there's certainly evidence that minors had easy access to the drug, both in the States and in Canada, prior to legalization.
So Canada just said, yes, we're going to legalize it this week. When are people going to be able to buy it and sell it?
It looks like mid-October. I think the target date that they've set is October 17th. So what's interesting in Canada is they are proceeding at the national level rather than the provincial level. They have a federal system like we do here in the States, but not all federal systems are created the same. And interestingly, in Canada, it's actually the national government that has primary responsibility for the criminal law. It's the flip side in the States. In the United States, it's the states that have primary responsibility for their area of law. So that's why I think the national government in Canada is doing this. So they're legalizing it. They're going to handle things like the production of marijuana, but they're leaving it to the provinces to regulate retail sales. And that's why, in part, it's going to take a little time to roll this out. The provinces say they need some time to formulate their own regulations to figure out what sort of stores they're going to allow and how they're going to regulate them. But the target date is ultimately about 12 weeks or so down the line, about mid-October.
We are talking about Canada's move to legalize marijuana. As you just heard, our guest Robert Mikos said that it'll be going online for sale in October. We are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. Let's try that again, 800-642-1234. Should legalized pot be legalized all over the United States? Should recreational pot be legalized all over the U.S. like it is in Canada? What do you think? 800-642-1234. Robert, I got to ask you, what's with Uruguay?
So Uruguay beat Canada to the punch, but lots of people are puzzling over what's actually going on there. So I think ultimately, you know, Uruguay isn't going to establish the same sort of system that Canada is. I think they're still figuring things out there. I think we have a much clearer picture of what's going to emerge in Canada. So Uruguay technically became the first nation to legalize recreational marijuana, but the details of that system are still to be worked out.
And I would have thought it would be something in Western Europe. I mean, you know, it's always been known that you can go to Amsterdam and get pot. I thought it was just legal there.
It's interesting that in Amsterdam, it's actually not legal. It's tolerated. It technically remains an offense under the law. Yet law enforcement, by practice, has agreed not to crack down on small-scale possession and small-scale distribution of the drug. So it's not that different than some jurisdictions in the United States where they might have still banned the drug, and yet they're just not enforcing those bans. So technically speaking, those it still remains an offense against the law in Western Europe. But again, that may change as it's changing in Uruguay and Canada and in the United States.
Is this possibly a violation of international law, moving to legalize pot as a nation?
It's a possibility. There are international drug control conventions or treaties that were championed by the United States decades ago, and that all... Yeah, they look at all drugs through the prism of medicine, and so they say you can allow certain drugs for medical uses, including marijuana. So a medical marijuana regime doesn't necessarily violate these conventions, but they don't accord any status or give any weight to recreational uses. So technically, it looks like Canada and Uruguay would be violating these international conventions. And I think that may put some pressure on the international community to go back and revisit these things, because you don't want countries sort of dropping out whenever it suits their interests.
Right. Is alcohol included in these conventions? Is that considered a drug?
No, it's not. And and what's interesting is that's the same under U.S. domestic law. So the Controlled Substances Act is a very expansive federal statute. It tries to regulate all psychoactive substances, but it makes an exception for two substances. One is alcohol, the other is tobacco. If those two substances were placed under the Controlled Substances Act, they'd probably be forbidden outright because they have no medical uses, or at least no approved medical uses, but they've been exempted from that regime, just like they have under international law.
We are talking about the legalization of marijuana in Canada this week. Any gardener out there knows how weeds grow and spread to neighboring plots of land? Will Canada's cannabis infect the U.S.? We most definitely want to take your calls on this. 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're exploring Canada's decision to legalize recreational pot, becoming the first industrialized nation to do so. You can call us, you can email us, you can tweet us. How do you feel about our neighbors to the north legalizing marijuana? Do you see this move having an impact on American drug policy? If so, how? And what would it take to legalize marijuana on the federal level in the U.S.? 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wppr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robert Mikos, we ended the last section talking about alcohol and that alcohol is an exception in terms of our drug laws. There is, when we're talking about marijuana laws and policing them, there is an issue in terms of drunk driving versus driving while under the influence of pot. It's not as easy to tell, is it?
That's correct. There's been no development yet of a device akin to a breathalyzer that we use for detecting alcohol impairment. There's no such device that we have now for marijuana. There are, of course, ways for the police to test, you know, for the presence of certain substances in your blood.
Like THC.
Being the THC, correct, the cannabinoids that are found in marijuana. But there's no agreement yet on exactly how much of those substances makes one impaired. So the development on the alcohol front with the breathalyzer was based on a lot of scientific evidence demonstrating, for example, that a certain blood alcohol content level made you impaired, made you less safe to drive. We just don't have the data yet on what, you know, amount of THC in your bloodstream or other cannabinoids in your urine would make you impaired. So that's a big gray area that lots of governments are facing now. How do you actually police restrictions on driving under the influence of this drug?
And THC tends to stay in your system longer than alcohol. I mean, it can be in there days, weeks later.
That's correct. So that makes it even more complicated because there are, you know, the THC will stay in your system for longer, and it'll be broken down into other metabolites that are sort of evidence of your use of marijuana. But again, it's not clear, you know, at what point does that stop becoming impairing on your system. So someone might fail a drug test weeks or even a month after they've consumed marijuana, but obviously at that point they're no longer under the influence, we might think, or no longer impaired by the substance.
We are talking about Canada's embrace of marijuana. They just legalized marijuana. It should be on sale in October, according to our guest. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call and tell us how you feel about legalizing pot. I want to talk about the financial aspect, because this is a huge financial aspect. Is Canada taxing marijuana? If so, how much are they taxing? Are the provinces getting a little cut of it? How does it work?
Yes, so they will be taxing the drug, much like states do in the United States. They have a revenue-sharing agreement with the provinces where I think the provinces will get the bulk of the money from these marijuana taxes, something like 70%. I think the initial projections aren't for huge sums of money to come in. I don't think they've actually set the precise rate yet. But one estimate that I've seen, for example, is for about $300 million Canadian annually from this drug.
$300 million. Nevada made $500 million in the first month. So why are Canadians shooting so low?
Well, that's $500 million in Nevada in, I think, sales and gross sales rather than...
Oh, that is true. Okay, that is a good point. So why are they shooting so low? It seems like a low number to me, though.
Well, one of the difficulties with setting a tax rate is that you don't want to set it so high that you'll push people back into the black market. So you try to set it low enough so that people are willing to go into legal stores and not resort to the black market where people aren't paying the taxes. But that means you're probably leaving some money on the table. You're probably forsaking some of those tax revenues. So I think that's part of the reason is they're trying to walk that line between making some money from this drug, but also ensuring that people are buying it through legal stores rather than through the black market.
So what is the tax, the sales tax on pot? Is that got to be worked out yet?
That still needs to be worked out in Canada. I know in the United States and in places like Colorado, it's typically a tax that's imposed oftentimes at the retail level. And the tax will be anywhere from 20% to 30% of the sales price of the drug. That depends on which local jurisdiction you're in, because in the United States, local governments oftentimes can impose their own taxes on the drug. But a 30% tax rate in the United States is not uncommon. And I expect that's close to what Canada will ultimately impose.
Cash is not only important. Money is not only important in terms of what the taxes will be, but there is a whole credit system that is available to businesses that set up pot in Canada that's not available here because our credit system is federal.
That's right, and that's one of the key differences between the U.S. and Canada. In Canada, since they're doing this at the federal level, at the national level, they can basically make sure that all the governments there are on the same page. The national government is going to give the provinces some discretion to, for example, set the age limit for getting pot, also for regulating where stores will be and how they'll be run. But otherwise, all the governments in Canada will be on the same basic page, which means that you don't have the same tension that you do between federal and state law as you do in the United States. And one of the big areas where you've got the biggest tension in the U.S. is with banking. These marijuana distributors who are licensed by the states still struggle to get banking services because all of their money under federal law is tainted. So all the financial transactions involving that money technically involve money laundering. Also trigger all sorts of reporting requirements that these banks have to adhere to. So it's very difficult in the United States for these companies to get banking services, to get credit card, handle credit card transactions and so on. In Canada, they won't have those same difficulties because the national government has given this drug its blessing.
We are talking about the legalization of pot in Canada. It's set to go on sale in October. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Pam from Richland Center, you have a really good question. Thank you for being here, Pam.
Yeah, I was interested in how it would affect the workforce because I know last week you had a guest that was saying how, you can have 10 good candidates, but only 3 will pass the drug test, and it's really hard to get qualified people in these job openings we have because of drug testing. So it'll be interesting to see, how that changes the sort of workforce availability.
Yeah, does the government of Canada or any state government here have control over private employers and what their drug policies are?
Yeah, in the United States, a handful of states have tried to extend employment protections to people who use the drug really for medical purposes off the job. So, for example, if you use another drug, like an opioid painkiller, like Percocet, even under federal law, you can't be fired by your employer unless that affects your job performance. You have those employment protections as a user of opioid painkillers, but you don't have those protections under federal law because marijuana, of course, is an illicit drug. It's not a reasonable accommodation to require an employer to allow you to use an illicit drug. But a few states have tried to extend their own state law protections to those workers. No state, as yet I'm aware of, has tried to extend the same protections to people who use the drug for recreational purposes off the job, even though there are some states that have laws that say you can't be fired from a job for any lawful behavior outside the workplace. The Colorado Supreme Court, in a very relevant case called Coates, just a couple of years ago, ruled that that particular state law protection didn't extend to marijuana because it's not lawful behavior, at least under federal law. So for medical marijuana users, the short answer is that a handful of states are trying to protect them from employment discrimination, but none have moved so far to protect recreational marijuana users, even for using the drug off the job.
But that argument doesn't hold in Canada because it is now legal under federal Canadian law. So will Canadian companies be able to say, hey, you have THC in your system, you're out of here?
Well, presumably, you know, if Canada has employment laws that are similar to those in the United States, then employers wouldn't be allowed to do that. The difficulty, of course, would be in, you know, figuring out, all right, how do we know, you know, from a drug test, for example, that's usually when this issue comes up, you know, the drug test will reveal you had some cannabinoid, THC, for example, in your system, is that evidence that you were actually impaired or that you were using it on the job? You know, employees aren't protected from using alcohol on the job any more than they'd be protected for using marijuana. So that'll be one of the practical difficulties. But in Canada, again, this is just assuming that their employment laws are structured similarly. Presumably, employees would have that protection that they lack here in the U.S.
We are talking about legalization of pot in Canada. We have been taking your calls, and we still are taking your calls. 800-642-1234. Robert Mikos, I want to talk about who can grow. You mentioned that the Canadian, the national government is overseeing the growing, and states are dealing with more minor regulations. But who can grow? Are they going to give a limited amount of licenses? And who's eligible for these licenses?
Yeah, so in Canada, that choice is going to be made by the national government. So the national government will be taking the lead in regulating producers. And one of the goals that they've stated for the rules that they'll adopt, they still need to hash out some of the details, but one of the goals they have is to have a lot of smaller, more diverse suppliers. That's at least a concern that they have. They don't want huge monopolies.
Mm.
Right now, what's interesting, if you look at their medical marijuana system, what the government has done to accommodate that right to use medical marijuana is that it's licensed just a small number, I think 30 or fewer producers to make medical marijuana to fulfill patient needs. It doesn't allow them to open stores. Instead, it's a mail order system where you actually, if you're a patient, you actually have to have the drug shipped to you from these producers. That part is going to change, but you might see a similar set of producers at the national level. But again, they're going to try to diversify that producer base and make sure that they don't have too many really big suppliers out there. The other thing they've done, and this, again, is very similar to what's been done in states in the United States that have legalized recreational marijuana, they will allow home grows.
Mm.
So every adults in Canada will be allowed to grow, I think it's 4 plants for their own needs and for their own consumption. So in addition to those licensed producers that will be controlled by the national government, you'll also have lots of individuals who are trying to grow the drug on their own.
We are talking about cannabis and the legalization of pot in Canada, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Diana from Graham, Minnesota. Diana, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to comment that I think marijuana is a stepping stone drug. People will take something, and if you give them an inch, they'll go the mile every time. So what's to say that you're growing a whole generation of people that will be doing pot. Where does it end? I mean, are they ready for the repercussions of what this brings about?
Okay, thank you very much, Diana. So marijuana as a gateway drug, Robert, is there evidence of that?
No. I think that's the easiest answer. Even the federal government, which, of course, hasn't been any fan of marijuana, acknowledges in its scheduling decisions that there's no evidence that if you use marijuana, you're more likely down the road to use other drugs, harder drugs like heroin and cocaine that everyone acknowledges are very harmful for you. So there's really no evidence to support that version of the gateway theory. What's interesting is that proponents of reforms have actually flipped this argument around, and they say that marijuana can actually be a beneficial gateway drug in the sense that people who are now using those harder drugs, and especially opioid painkillers, if they're allowed to use medical marijuana to treat their pain, for example, that they'll abandon those harder drugs and turn towards medical marijuana. Again, the jury is still out on that version of the gateway hypothesis, but it's interesting that the evidence so far is inconclusive, and there are two sides to this particular story.
You know, I've even heard of people saying that alcoholics can recover by smoking pot. The alcoholics I know don't even want to deal with that issue. But is that maybe true?
It's a possibility. I mean, there are lots of theories out there, and one of the interesting things now is that we have more and more data out there that we can use to test these different theories rigorously, because we have so many different experiments going on in the United States, and now we'll have Canada weighing in as well. So we might eventually be able to figure out whether there's a relationship between marijuana use and use of these other drugs and what that relationship is, although I'd caution anyone that it's really difficult to untangle that relationship. There's so much going on, so many different things you need to control for that. Yeah, you have to take any study that's done now, regardless of what it says, with a big grain of salt.
We are talking about the intricacies of legalized marijuana as the world is now watching Canada, which legalized it this week and is going to be growing and selling it come October. We are taking your calls here on The Morning Show, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We are talking about legalized marijuana on The Morning Show this morning. Canada just legalized marijuana, and it will be for sale in October. Robert Mikos is with us. He's trying to kind of suss out what the legalities are, how it works. Robert, thank you for being with us. I want to talk about Jeff Sessions. I want to talk about the different people who are making drug policy in this country under Obama and now under Trump. Jeff Sessions has said that he doesn't think that it's legal for states to be making their own marijuana policy. He's going to be cracking down. He wants to crack down on states, and he wants to crack down on growers for violating federal law. Is this going to be an issue with Canada, or are we going to be seeing a beef up of our northern borders?
I suspect not. And a big part of the reason is that even though the Attorney General has expressed a lot of misgivings about marijuana legalization and a lot of antipathy towards the drug, at least for recreational purposes, he's been in office now for over a year. And there's been no crackdown, even in the United States. So even though he's got these misgivings, he hasn't attempted so far to launch a campaign to get federal prosecutors to go out there and bring cases against the industry. So I would be very surprised if, even though people are growing and selling this within our own borders, and they're not being targeted, I'd be very surprised if suddenly he turned his attention north and took aim at Canada and Canadian producers. So I'm skeptical that this would require the building of a wall, so to speak, with Canada in the same way that's been proposed for Mexico.
On the flip side, though, are policymakers here looking to see how Canada fares, maybe as a model in the future for us?
I think that's a possibility. I don't think they will feel any pressure from Canada to do this, especially given the recent interactions between the United States and Canada. I don't think it's going to add to the pressure here to legalize it. But one thing that the Canadian legislation will do is it will provide a model for how to allocate authority over this drug between the national government and the states. In the United States, we have some proposals in Congress to change federal law, like Cory Booker's Marijuana Justice Act. There's another more recent proposal from Senator Cory Gardner and Senator Elizabeth Warren, the States Act. But those proposals that are now in Congress basically say that the federal government is going to cede almost all control over this drug to the states. Canada isn't doing that, of course. As I mentioned, the national government will have a lot of different regulations of producers. It'll regulate the marketing of the drug, put some limits on what the provinces may do. So that may provide an alternative model, one that doesn't just hand over the keys to this policy domain to the states here, but says there's a valuable role for the federal government to play.
We are talking about the legalization of marijuana in Canada. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Leon in Verona, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. As a person of age that's been around this drug for a long time, I see its pros and cons, and I'm not exactly for it, and I'm not exactly against it. I think it's going to come, and I think it needs to be regulated. But my question is, how is this, in this country, still considered to be a Schedule One drug? And the reason I ask that is because it seems to be the major contentious point of conflict between the federal government and state government, that during the Nixon administration, this was classified a Schedule One drug, similar to the opioids, the heroin, and the other narcotics. Is there a concerted effort to get this removed as a Schedule One drug? Because I think that would go a long way into deflating some of these contentious points that we're having. I'll take my answer off here.
Thank you very much, Leon. Robert?
Yeah, so part of the reason, or the biggest reason why marijuana remains on Schedule One, that's Schedule One of this Controlled Substances Act, is that there's no one has yet demonstrated with the scientific degree of certainty that federal law requires, no one's yet demonstrated a medical use for the drug, a medical benefit from the drug. The problem here, if you want to call it that, is that this Controlled Substances Act that Congress adopted more than 40 years ago looks at all of these psychoactive substances through the lens of medicine and says these will be legal if and only if you can use them to treat a medical condition. It made exceptions, as I mentioned before, for alcohol and tobacco, but everything else has to be viewed through that lens. And the problem when it comes to marijuana is that no one's been able to offer the proof that federal agencies require to demonstrate, you know, medical utility from this drug. So that's why, ultimately, you know, this remains on Schedule I under federal law. And it's very difficult to satisfy those, you know, to build the evidence that you need to get it off of there. So taking it off Schedule I, you know, even if someone was able to demonstrate some medical utility and move it, say, to Schedule II or Schedule III, that wouldn't necessarily resolve all the tension between state and federal law, because then it would still be regulated as a medical substance. And you still wouldn't allow people to use it for recreational purposes. So you would really need Congress to step in. I don't think a federal agency could do this, but you would need Congress to step in and deschedule the drug, to simply say that this framework under the Controlled Substances Act no longer applies to this particular drug. That's what Congress did for alcohol and tobacco. If it did that for marijuana, you would, you know, remove a lot of the headaches, a lot of the tension between state and federal law.
Leon spoke of pros and cons. Chuck from Onalaska also wants to speak a little bit about pros and cons. Welcome, Chuck.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a physician who takes care of a lot of patients with drug addiction. And I can speak to the fact that I really don't see a whole lot of feedback obtained from doctors who provide this care. The American Society of Addiction Medicine is not in favor of legalization of medical marijuana or regular marijuana for recreational purposes. A big part of it is we just do not, I'm not speaking for them, I'm speaking for myself, but my interpretation of the discussions that have occurred is that we don't need another drug that's addicting and that has negative consequences for so many people.
So when you are treating patients who are addicted to marijuana, what are the consequences? What does that look like?
Well, first of all, you can have argument as to whether it is a gateway drug or not, but I will tell you very few people start out their use of drugs by saying, oh, I think I'll use heroin today. Almost everyone has used marijuana and alcohol in excess prior to starting using what a lot of people call hard drugs. So as far as the addictions and the patients that we take care of, it's oftentimes, again, the fact that it isn't used solitary, but it's used in conjunction with other drugs. Mm. So I take care of pregnant women with drug addiction, and I have to go through a fairly long litany of the potential harms associated with it and also speak to the fact that there are a lot of studies that are lacking. There are no studies that demonstrate that it causes an increased risk of birth defects. There are quite a few studies that indicate it may be associated with premature labor and other complications of the third trimester. And then, of course, breastfeeding in women on marijuana is strongly recommended against because THC actually concentrates within breast milk.
Very interesting, Chuck. Thank you for sharing that with us. Robert Mikos, I have known people who are addicted to pot. They don't have a whole lot of motivation, and they can't stop smoking pot. As the doctor just said, there's not a lot of science that says anything more. But this is not all roses and sunshine. There are some dark sides to this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, no one thinks that this is a harmless substance. But the question is, you know, even if you think some people are going to be harmed by this, either because they're addicted or because they use it while pregnant and pass on to the fetus or pass on to a nursing baby, is prohibiting the drug and in particular criminalizing it, is that the best way to stop them? The same arguments that are levied against marijuana could be levied against other substances like alcohol and tobacco, and yet we recognize that, you know, just prohibiting them, criminalizing the possession and use of them, probably isn't a wise strategy. So, in a way, I think everyone shares these concerns, maybe to different degrees, but a lot of the disagreement here is over how you address them. And maybe the way to address them is, you know, through treatment options, through education, maybe by limiting marketing, maybe by taxing the drug and making it a little bit more expensive, a little bit hard to overconsume, regulating its potency and so on, rather than just banning it outright, which might be too harsh on the one hand and too ineffective on the other.
Robert Mikos is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University. His research looks at the struggle among federal, state, and local governments for control of marijuana law and policy. He's also author of the book, Marijuana Law, Policy, and Authority. And he joined us today to kind of make sense of Canada's decision to legalize marijuana. It's The Morning Show.